Casual for Humans, Episode 12.
Processes and tools dominate today's Agile discussions, but we are devoted to the individuals and interactions that make it work. From the beginner to the veteran practitioner, we have something for you. Welcome to Agile for Humans.
All right, welcome to this week's episode of Agile for Humans. I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. Joining me this week, a return guest, one of my favorite co-hosts, Zach Boniker. Zach, how you doing, sir?
I am great, Ryan. Always great to be here. Thanks again for having me.
We've pulled in another host to join us tonight, a very special guest, Mr. Woody Zuhl. Woody, how are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing great, Ryan. So I'll share you right off the bat a little saying from Tom Peters. And excellence is about the next 5 minutes. And I think that's a pretty cool thing.
I do too. It's
because beyond 5 minutes, we have no way to know what could possibly happen. But
yeah, let's keep it in the now.
I have a feeling good things will happen. But yeah.
I think good things will happen. So guys, tonight, between the three of us, I think there's 1,000 different topics. We could probably do a marathon podcast. However, our other obligations will prevent us from doing so. But tonight, I was thinking, let's take a different tact. Instead of the usual topics, Woody, that you get barraged with regularly, I was wondering if we could talk about experimentation tonight. The idea of just posing questions and trying new things.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I'm on board.
So Woody, of course, many of our listeners are very familiar with your work, but if not, you know, Woody's a pioneer in the Agile software space. He's brought mob programming to the forefront of Agile practices. No Estimates is also one of the hashtags that he's very active on, and one of, I think, the three main advocates for, and also just incredibly generous with his time within the Agile community, one of the mentors of our groups, and just a, you know, a very active person in the community. Something I've always wondered about the questions that you ask, though, Woody, is where do they come from? Because you seem to question things that all of us at some point or another in our careers have taken for granted. I know that part of my career, estimates were just something that you always do. You take a task, you go back to your cubicle and you work alone. And those were just the normal things. And it never even occurred to me at certain points to question it. But it seems like you're taking those things, questioning them, bringing new practices to the forefront and turning every dial to 11. I'm wondering if you have some insights into what drives your inquiries and what is it about some of these practices that you sense that so many others don't?
Yes. Yeah, so first off, you're really overselling me, but I appreciate that. Yeah, what it comes down to is this. A long, long time ago, I worked with a fellow. I was just a kid. I don't know exactly how old. I think it was 12, 13, 14. But I worked with a fellow who was probably in his 50s or 60s. He owned a plant nursery where he actually bred and raised hybridized daylilies, Hemerocallis, and he also was he was really into roses. He did a lot of experimenting. His background was as a chemist, and he had traveled all over the world collecting plant samples in his younger days. And he settled into this little town where I was growing up, and he had this plant nursery. And I think that I didn't discover the idea of what I'm doing as far as questioning things there, but it really opened my eyes up a bit to it. So what I found with him was there was almost nothing that he took for granted. He just, you know, if he read about something that seemed like a marvelous new practice, he would experiment with it. If he read about something that was that people were saying, we tried this and it isn't working for us, well, he would want to try the experiments and see why it wasn't working. You know, it wasn't about it wasn't about just taking things for granted. And again, I don't know that I got that from him, but he sure emphasized it for me. And as a little kid, you know, I was pretty open to these ideas, and I actually found it rather intriguing to just look at something and say, well, now why is it happening that way? And what if we do this? And so on. He gave me a little soil test kit. I don't know if you guys have ever had one of those. Like, they were these old wooden boxes, these little wooden boxes. They were full of little chemicals for testing the acidity and the different nutrient levels in the soils. So that was a wonderful thing for me, too. It's like, get inquisitive. And I think it was his way of saying, you know, at age 12 or 13 or 14, whatever you were, this is a great time to start getting inquisitive about stuff. and he'd set little things out for me to do. So maybe I've gone a little too long on that, but this goes back that far in my life. I'm not a young guy. And what I noticed over the years, no matter where I worked, was that there were things taken for granted in how we should do things. I'm perfectly open to just taking things for granted when it doesn't seem to matter. But with things that seem to matter, then I want to know more. And I use this in my maxims. You know, I question everything about the way I do my work. I especially question the things that I have the most faith in or the most belief or trust in. The things that I just think are absolutely true, those are the things I want to question the most.
I can remember you, I was attending a conference that you were speaking at, Woody, and it was one of the first times I think I had ever seen your talk on pure Agile or real Agile, and you had introduced ideas in there like estimating and, you know, no time boxes and things like that. And I remember that was God, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And I can remember thinking to myself, wow, that's interesting. Yeah, what would happen if we did, you know, free ourselves of these things? I noticed in the room there were so many people that had their eyes like they were deer in headlights at some of the things you were saying because it challenged all their assumptions, right? So if you're kind of an inquiring mind, how do you find the best way to engage people with your questioning in a way that brings them into the conversation?
Oh, that's an excellent thing to ponder. Over the years, I started off with software development about 30 plus years ago, but I owned some other businesses at that time, and I was using the software I was writing for some specific things I wanted to do, controlling some machines, collecting data off some machines, bookkeeping and stuff that you couldn't buy software for easily that you could actually count on, because that was what was driving me to get into it. And so I found out after 15 years of doing that I was more interested in software development than in the other things I was doing. So I took a step out into managing a project for somebody where there were 4 or 5 developers, and they needed the main guy needed to do some traveling, and he wanted someone on hand that he knew that he could trust and that knew programming that could run things while he was gone. Actually, he was gone for a day or two at a time, and we were doing some very critical work that had to be. It dealt with some pretty important things. So I said, sure, I'll do it. And he was basically doing what we would now call extreme programming. And I learned a lot from him. This was only a 3-month contract. There were a lot of practices that they were doing that were not common, and a lot of things that they were doing that have become very common now. After that 3 months, which I thought, boy, I'm really glad I've moved into this as my vocation. I'm going to love this. Then I found the next place I went, they weren't doing anything like that. Yeah. And I started watching all the dysfunction. And I like to think of it that way, because they could have had it highly wonderful there. And what they were basically doing was making an environment where nobody could excel at their work. So how do you bring somebody forward from that to there's some better ways we can do it?
Yeah, very carefully, right? With a lot of respect, I'm sure.
Not at that time, maybe. But yeah, I've learned that since then. No, I was feeling very much so there that all I need to do is nudge people in the right direction, and we could see a little bit of improvement. It started making me think, you know, how do we help make things better? When we don't really know what better is, all we know is that a lot of stuff isn't very good. Like if you ever see anybody at work break out in tears because of how they're being treated, you know that's, I hope everybody would know that's not a good thing. And when you see those kinds of things, you go, well, there's got to be a better way to do it than this. And I'm going to flatly state right here that I've been a boss many years. I've done all kinds of stuff that I would go back now and tell my original self back then to not do that. But sometimes that's how you learn. At that time, it was just me noticing the problems and starting to say we can do better. And that's when, like with the whole no estimates thing, in a way started there for me. Not that we want to talk about no estimates, but the idea that I was noticing a pattern. And this pattern I have come to call the pattern of continuous no improvements. And what I noticed that during their iterations, which this was pre-Agile, their iterations were 6 weeks. At the end of each period, they would do a sort of a gather together and see how things are going. You could think of it as a lessons learned. Now we might call it a retrospective. It wasn't quite facilitated that way. But I could see that they had some problems coming up, and they wanted to work on them. They worked on them. They worked hard to make them go away. They discussed them and analyzed and took plans and actions to do this. And then they would gather again in 6 weeks, and they'd still have the same problem. And so they'd set out to solve them, and in 6 weeks they'd have the same problem. Okay, so to me this is a pattern. And this is a pattern that sometimes points to the idea that we're dealing with the symptom and not the problem. And we have to start saying, well, what's the problem here? That goes for many, many, many things. whenever I see that, so that's, you asked, you know, how do I go about questioning, or how do I go about asking the right questions about things? I want to know, what are the things that we have as recurring problems that we think we're trying to solve? And let's see if we are actually dealing with the problem. And that, then we can introduce this idea of a five whys inquiry or a five whys session. But there are other ways too. There's more mild ways to do it than five whys, because five whys is not an easy thing to do. We could start in a gentler way. But there you go. So I would say, really, the most important thing is to watch for the things that are going well and turn them up, while at the same time, watch for the things that are that we might be addressing the symptom rather than the problem itself.
I've stolen a line from Michael Spade, and so I'll say it right now. I stole it from Michael Spade. His tagline to this tagline of benevolent troublemaker.
And oh, there
I,
you
I've
go.
Used that because I've loved that. It's kind of felt like a lot of what I do when I get in and I'm asking a lot of questions, kind of making trouble, but designed towards a good thing. And I in everything that you said, I guess I can really relate to it, because I mean, it's difficult though for me sometimes, Woody. I don't know if you feel the same way, but there's times when I can feel my agenda, whether it be a team or an organization, a system of work, where I feel like I know the direction that it should go, but I know that I can't just suggest it because there are people that are kind of oblivious. It is the status quo and they're comfortable in there. And that's kind of why I asked the question about how do you invoke change, or how do you evoke change when you know where it should go, but you're a little hesitant of being able to just outright experiment or to tell people that they need to change.
So that's intriguing, because I never know what's the right way to go. I'm going to discover that. And I really want to make that clear. If I knew, you know, how to do things that would solve these problems, then they wouldn't be problems. So I often know, like, let's just say I was brought into a company and they said, Woody, we want to really learn what it means to be agile, or to transform our company to be agile, or adopt agile, or adapt to agile, or some kind of a term that nobody gets mad at you for using when you talk about doing agile. Because when you say doing agile, then they get mad at you because you can't do it, you know, and that's all right. I kind of like that.
Woody, don't do agile, be agile.
That's right.
Come on.
Right. And that's good. I mean, I'll go along with anything anybody says about that kind of stuff. These little war words, words about words are kind of goofy. I don't really see, and now somebody's going to get, better cut that out. I don't see a lot of.
No, let's leave it and say it again. The war of words is goofy.
Yeah. So I mean, it's just like, okay, let's, you know, in a conversation like this, we can just move past it. I don't really know the right terminology, you know, but I think that so if somebody came to me and said, look, come in here, we want to do this. I only have a few principles that I work by. And one is, I believe that the people doing the work can best determine how to do that work. If they are given the freedom, if that's the right word, if they're liberated to be able to work in an environment where they're allowed to do that and they understand that they are free to do that, then they will excel. They're going to figure it out. I don't really know how to put that in place for someone. That's something we discover in any particular situation. There's some really great sayings about this stuff. I'm going to share one with you. I think that the beginning point for me in any of these things is that we often come to the point where we want to know how to do something when that's the end of the path. The beginning is figuring out the right questions to ask. So this comes from Peter Block. And I love this quote from him. Transformation comes more from pursuing profound questions than seeking practical answers. So if we find the right questions to pursue, when we finally get to where we're understanding that, the how reveals itself.
Yeah.
So when somebody asks me, well, how can we do X or how can we do Y? You see that a lot with the no estimates stuff. You know, that's not the space that I am living in. My space is, hey, I've noticed some things. I want to talk about these things, and I want to figure out what are the right questions for me to be asking myself. about these things that I most believe in?
I think you've hit the right questions. And the reason I say that, this is purely anecdotal. And I understand that that's not a researched or well-proven kind of thing. But the stories and the questions resonate. And they not only resonate, they resonate with a large group of people. And to me, when you stumble onto a question such as, why are we estimating so much? And you actually get a lot of participation around a hashtag, which is somewhat unusual on Twitter, right? There's not a devoted following to many hashtags in my experience, but No Estimates has developers, managers, you know, C-level, there's all sorts of people following this hashtag, engaged in a conversation about something that has resonated across organizations, across domains, across, you know, whether you're a contractor, a full-time employee, a business owner, these things resonate. Same with mob programming. People realize that we're social creatures. We were born to communicate. We were given two ears and a mouth and a brain that was, they're all designed to work in tandem to communicate, convey ideas. So why would we work solo?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question itself, is why, so right off the bat, I don't know the right questions to be asking about this, but we can pose a couple. One is, why do we work in the work patterns that we currently work in? What are the patterns? That's another question. Where did they come from for us? Why are we using them? You know, one thing I like to, somebody pointed this out to me a while back, you know, we did not have even anything close to written language or some kind of a way of writing things until about 5,000 years ago. So where we're at right now is, you know, we have lots of written communications. But overall, depending on how far back man's history goes or human's history goes, we probably spend a lot more time not communicating with writing than we have with writing. And I think it goes for most of humanity. It's just the last 300-400 years at the most that it was generally something people could do, and maybe just the last few hundred years that what you might consider the typical person was able to read or write. So how much experience do we have with those things? So that's one of the questions I would want to ask. You know, why? What makes us think that what we're doing right now is the best way? Can we look back and say, I would ponder that. So this is a good thing, like with mob programming. Now, I'll share one thing there with mob programming. When I first started talking about mob programming, it was at the Agile Alliance 2012, not maybe the very first time, but the first time at a larger conference, I suppose. That was in Grapevine, Texas, near Dallas. And several people came up to me and had asked, what is this thing we're hearing about, this where you guys are all working together? And after the third time, like within 20 or 30 minutes of somebody coming up and asking me and me kind of trying to explain, I said, I'll put together an open jam session tomorrow. Let me gather some things and my thoughts, and I will do a presentation. So I started, the people kept coming. I don't know how many, but it was 10 or 12 that day. And so that's what I did. So what I did was just, I asked the guys, I sent an email to my crew back at Hunter. I asked them to just take a couple pictures and write a list of all the things that they could think about that what mob programming meant to them. We came up with a list of 20 things, and I started, and I presented that to a crowd of, I don't know, 20 people in that open jam. And people started asking questions. So I wrote them down. I could answer some, but I wrote the questions down, and that became the basis of my presentation on mob programming. I would ask the question that somebody asked, and then I would try to answer it. So the one that I want to share here is the first question everybody asks. Maybe I should ask you guys, what do you think would be the first question people ask when they first are exposed to the idea of five or six people working on one thing at one time at one computer?
How do you get anything done?
That's a good question, and that's one that I've often heard. But that's not the one that I've heard first or most.
How does it make sense to pay six people to do the work of one person?
That's sort of it.
Kind of what I was alluding to, yeah.
Yeah. So how do you get things done, or how can you get things done, or how do you, you know, that's a good question too, because I hear that as well. But that first question, so at first I would just say, well, I don't know. It just we get a lot of stuff done. We noticed we get a lot of stuff done. How can we do it? I don't know. So we started pondering that. And I pondered that question for a week or two, and then I started, this is a little trick that I do on myself. What's the inverse of that question? So what would be the opposite question, not the opposite, but a driving question that's sort of the other side of that, and this is what I came up with. What are the things that destroy productivity? So where we could ask, how can you be productive? Let's ask the opposite. You know, when somebody now asks, how can you be productive? I want to ask this question of myself. What are the things that destroy productivity? That's easy to list out. And as a matter of fact, whenever I give this talk on mob programming, which can take an hour or so, I ask that question to the audience. And they invariably come up with at least a short list of these things. We came up with something like 20 things, and I think I've listed out about 40 now that I've heard over time. There's a group of really common questions or common answers to that. One is communication problems. Another is thrashing, the idea that people get context switching. Another one is meetings. Another one thing that destroys productivity is technical debt. So those are just a few of the items. And if I ask that of an audience of 50 or 100 people who want to share back with me, I will hear all the things that I could mention and more. And then I try to cover them. Well, that's where we started. Okay, why aren't we, what are the communication problems that we came up, you know, that we saw, and why don't we have them anymore? Because we never set out to solve any of those problems. That's a critical thing. We just noticed they faded away. When we start working well together as a group, the kinds of problems that I've often seen just faded away. They were no longer there. You don't need to coordinate 5 or 6 people very much when they're always coordinated. You don't need to get alignment with 5 or 6 people who are always in alignment. So the communication issues with trying to keep people aligned and the load of management and trying to keep people aligned and working kind of in the same direction dissipates. You don't need that.
Woody, when you hear people, you know, you give a mob programming talk, for example, and then you hear people say, wow, that was, and they're really inspired by it, obviously. Do you feel concerned that people will just go out and do it without understanding all the whys that you've realized and why that system worked for a group of people and why it might work for other people? Or do you encourage people, hey, just go out there and try these things? Like when you have an experiment, just go out and try it and see what happens.
So I've seen right now, I know of at least 20 or 30 companies or groups around the world that have been doing mob programming to some degree, some of them full time. One of them in particular, I believe they were introduced to mob programming by seeing that little 3-minute video that we made back in 2012 of us working for a day, and it's time-lapse.
Time-lapse camera.
That's right. And yeah. They saw that, and then they had shared with them. I wasn't there, and I didn't know they were doing this. It was just, hey, here's an interesting thing. A consultant or a coach was there helping them. Here's an interesting thing. You know, look at this. What do you think of this? And then, so they showed the video, and then they gave a couple simple guidelines that we use. The main one being the strong pairing mechanism that Llewellyn Falco devised. And that's the idea that for an idea to go from somebody's head into the computer, it has to go through someone else's hands. And that's a very simple but extremely powerful concept. But they were just given those two little things and maybe a couple others, because we have our principle of behaving nicely to each other, be excellent to each other, or as we put it, treat each other with kindness, consideration, and respect. I don't think they were given much more than that. 15 minutes and off and running. And now they're also doing it quite a bit, and they're sharing it at conferences and so on. This is a group in England. Some of the people who have been going around and doing this, you know, some of the, I would say, more coach types, they're just sharing this concept. It's up to whoever hears it to take the actions themselves. I will share one thing that I think is critically important. I put it into every talk that I do. The talk of mob programming isn't about mob programming. It's about getting good at retrospectives. If you really figure out how to be good at retrospectives, retrospectives aren't about how do we keep it fun or how do we keep it engaging and these sorts of things, which is, that's great. But to me, I would almost say, if we're looking for ways to keep it fun and engaging, I would take that as a smell. And to me, a smell is an indication of a possible problem. I don't think a smell indicates a problem. It's like if I walk into my home here and I go, boy, it smells like something like an animal got in here, and I better go seek this out. And then I just find that I left a banana peel behind the chair. All I got to do is throw the banana peel outside on the pile heap of stuff out front of my house, and the smell goes away. I don't have to do anything special. It wasn't a problem. It was just the odor was there. But sometimes it is something worse, and you got to take care of it. Yeah. So that's sort of how I use a smell. A smell is just an idea that if we notice something that is a bit, you know, stinky, then we should investigate. And if we find it is a problem, then we can go further. You know, yeah. So that's what I see about, you know, this is the thing with retrospectives. If they aren't engaging, let's figure out what it is that we really need to do to be engaged on the purpose of the retrospective. And I take retrospectives very seriously, but that doesn't mean it's a serious time where everybody's sitting there with a grumpy look on their face. We can do them very quickly. We can also take our time at them if we feel that we'd like to. But the key to it is, don't wait too long before you do the next retrospective. If in 10 minutes something wonderful happens, as soon as you get a chance, a minute later, reflect on it and say, what can we tune and adjust now, seeing what we just saw?
Yeah, Woody, what do you think is the biggest barrier that you've seen on teams to having meaningful, productive retrospectives?
Yeah, I'd have to give that quite a bit of thought. I for a while there, sure. I was getting invited to companies to come and kind of watch their practices, how they were doing things. And one thing that I noticed that I thought was particularly bad was having a process in place that we couldn't deviate from. That it was thought that if we do these steps, you know, and do them just right, we're going to have the results we want. So I wouldn't say necessarily that's always bad, but I think a retrospective has got to be a much less controlled thing. But, you know, hey, whatever works for you. If in your organization you're at the place where that just isn't going to happen, then maybe that's something we could take a baby step towards. But that's one thing I've noticed frequently, to see these retrospectives where it was clear that the process was more important than the people, than the interactions.
Yeah, I'll share a little bit that kind of ties both the what you just talked about with mob programming and the whys behind it and retrospectives. That you'll probably enjoy this, Woody. I had the opportunity a couple months ago, since, you know, I still talk with, you know, your old team at Hunter, the mob, Jason Kearney and Chris Lucian and Dexter and Aaron, all. So I took a team to go sit down with the mob and Hunter, and they got to spend a day in the mob with them. And one that was pretty awesome, just to, you know, have them experience that culture and that dynamic, exactly what you talked about, the idea of respecting and trusting one another. And that was a real big thing for them. They're like, wow, that we really kind of want that in our team. But one of the big takeaways that they also had in getting to, you know, really, really mob for a day was that there was almost an on-demand retro. So just like what you said about not waiting. Wow, that was awesome. Let's retrospect on that. What did we do to make that happen? You know, and they acted on it right away. And it wasn't a big structured ceremony with a big, you know, bunch of sticky notes and a big ceremony around this. It was just very pointed. It was very specific, but it stayed very true to the team culture of respect and conversation. But it was very directed, and there was clearly meaning and a real strong desire behind that. And they took that, and they said, the team that I was with, they came back and said, you know, when something happens, we need to ensure from a team perspective, we always have a safe place in our team, because we should retrospect when something happens that matters. And we can't do that unless we always have that safe place. And it's what we want. So they took a lot. It's funny. They didn't even get into a lot of the technical practices and really being impressed by, even though they got a good demonstration or insight into, you know, things like TDD and such, but it was almost the trust and the safety in the team and the ability and the desire to want to act on continuous improvement the second they notice something. And that was a really big takeaway. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, someone shared with me once the idea that if you can just improve things 0.1% a day, you know, that you're going to come out better. And I saw a quote that I've been using recently. I don't have it off the top of my head, but basically find some way to make it so that things will be better tomorrow every day. And those are all part of, I would consider, somewhat common, philosophies or parts of philosophies. Just the basic idea that I shared at the beginning, about Tom Peters, you know, excellence mm-hmm. is about the next 5 minutes. Now, that's not an exact quote of his, maybe, but I hope it's close enough. There's one from Emerson that's kind of closely related. And if you don't mind me doing another quote, but he said,
no, please.
To finish the moment, to find the journey's end in every step of the road, to live the greatest number of good hours is wisdom. This is very closely related to that. So these are deep things, in my opinion, that we kind of lose in the rapid pace of the way we're doing things. But the beauty of this rapid pace of the way we're doing things is it exists because the mechanisms are in place to have them exist. And those mechanisms kind of give us the path forward. So we have this rapid pace today because communication is so easy to do. Like the three of us here are together in one space, but I don't know where you guys are. You're in some other part of the country or the world, for that matter. And so we can do things we couldn't have done easily, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, or even 10 years ago in a lot of cases. So, you know, this rapid pace of change that we have right now is also, it's giving us some problems, but it's giving us some marvelous new ways to do things. So it's all good. So I'll share one thing about that instant retrospective concept. It came to me once a long time ago that if we wait to reflect on stuff, then we'll lose the essence of it. So I was working with someone whom their pattern was, oh, we just keep this journal and we write down all the things that happened and then we kind of graph it up here. You know, we put, oh, this is what was happening at that time, this was happening at this time. And I thought, well, that's first of all, interesting, and it seems like a lot of work. How well is it working for you? And so I looked at what they were doing, and I think by the time they got to where they were actually using that information, the essence of it had dissipated, and people weren't really that interested at that moment anymore. So if a big problem comes along, we feel it's important to deal with it right now. But when these little moments happen, we kind of set them aside and deal with them later. And I like to see those little things can give us that 0.1% improvement. Why not pluck those as well?
I've had this question on my mind that came up from something that you said earlier, Woody, when we were talking about if we're observing systems or we're observing people, you never feel like you have an agenda or a specific way of working or something in mind. And I want to press you a little bit on that with a question, because I know in having talked with you and learned from you, you believe very strongly in the values and principles informing systems of work, from the Agile Manifesto. You really believe in that as a way of being and working. Wouldn't you see that sometimes and think to yourself, I want to send them in a direction that is more informed by these, you know, by Agile, by the values, by the principles that we believe in? And I guess the question I'll ask is, if you were to test a company, if a company said, I'm Agile, or we're Agile, or a team, or whoever, what would you look for? What would you test, or what would you measure to be able to say, yeah, I think you guys are on the right track?
Oh, that's a tough one. So
I mean,
first of all,
is there a right way? I mean, is there something that we would look for?
So what I believe the Agile Manifesto is about, and I would say it's pretty rock solid. It was a gathering of ideas of a certain time and a certain place, but I think it's almost timeless. What they did there was put together some pretty good stuff that we can use as a philosophy of software development.
Yeah, means
it's
of thinking.
Basically, what's that?
A means of thinking, right? A way to
a way to think
to start
about
from.
It. That's right. And so what they did there was they did the best they could agree to, I think. I wasn't there. I don't know. But I don't think they would have all signed this if they didn't all agree to some aspect of it that they found. So basically what they did is they put together this way that we can use to guide us in making decisions about the specific practices that we're going to do. Yeah, I like to think of it this way. We have these guides, but we have to have a way to fulfill them. So if you think of it as a philosophy, which is sort of a way to think about practical affairs of humans, a way to do things. So we need the things that we will do, but the guides allow us to choose those things that we'll do. So it's really easy to take that Agile manifesto and kind of use it as a way to ask about any particular practice an organization is doing. What does this support? What is this doing to support the guidance that we've been given? An example would be sustainability. So if we have a practice of you have to work during the last 2 weeks before a deployment, you have to work an extra 2 hours a day, then I would want to ask, how does that support what the Agile manifesto says? As a matter of fact, I think there's enough studies out there that even slight pressures lead to bad decision making. So we would have to have a pretty good example for ourselves, a good way to verify that making everybody work an extra 2 hours every day. And I was on one of these once where we were invited to work all weekend without sleep.
Invited, right?
Yeah, invited, which pretty much meant you've got to come in. And people would just fall asleep on the floor. And this was at a pretty big place with lots and lots of people. They would find a place under their desk to fall asleep when they needed to sleep. I don't think that we were making very good decisions after the first day, but it went on for 3 days.
Wow.
What of that can we say was is living up to the guidance that we have? Now, I don't believe that the Agile Manifesto is complete. I think there's other things we could have added to it or could, and so I do. You know, when I think something's important, I bring it along with me. And on the other hand, does everything in there belong? And I think it pretty much does. And maybe we just need to tweak it a little bit as we become better and better technically at doing some of the things it asks for. But most of it, you know, it's pretty dang good. So that's what I would say. If you can show me that any practice that you're using pretty much supports, so I think of it this way. The practices we have is a set of ever-evolving practices and ever-evolving set of practices. So let's say we have 20 or 30 things that we do typically, and let's say one of them is TDD, test-driven development, and we use that. How is it supporting us in being agile, if that's the way we want to think of it? What is it helping us to do? Now, I'm not going to get into a discussion right now about that. I just wanted to make a point. If we're doing retrospectives and we're using some particular practices in those retrospectives, those I would want to look at them and say, what specifically is this doing in addressing the concerns that were addressed or were available in the Agile Manifesto? And when I say the Agile Manifesto, I mean the values and the principles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we could have come up with something else. These were just 17 concerned people who gathered together. They'd been talking about these things in various ways, and they wanted to see where they were, I guess. And they came up with this, and I'm just so thankful they did. Matter of fact, I'll take this a big step further. As soon as I read that, which was several years after I first started being exposed to extreme programming ideas, I said, that is exactly the four values particularly, that's exactly what I had learned when I was first being exposed to extreme programming. Let's really focus on working with the customer. Let's really focus on the individuals and the interactions, the ability of people to work well together. Let's really focus on this idea that we're building software, so let's make sure that we're getting it into use. Working software. That means it's in use, you know? In my opinion, of course, somebody there is going to tell me I'm wrong. That's all right. you know, responding to change, I mean, that's, these are brilliant things. These are brilliant things. But anyway, so there you go. I know I rambled off your topic maybe a little bit.
No, it's good. It's great.
I'm going to hijack back for a second.
Take your show back, Ryan. Take it back.
No. I like the questions. I like where you're going. I recently did the Certified Scrum Product Owner class with Jason Tanner and Aaron Koppel. And while I wasn't necessarily worried about another certification, I'm fascinated by the product approach that these two gentlemen have. You know, Jason and Aaron have a really unique view. Aaron's more lean startup, very deep background into that. So he brought a lean startup approach. And then Jason has just a phenomenal mind around road mapping, specifically story mapping. And then also the way that he approaches teams, I really like. And an exercise that at first I hated, but then immediately loved afterwards, was the force ranking of the 12 Agile principles by the participants in the room. And so he, of course, took the first one off, right? You know, the above all else, we value delighting the customer by frequent delivery of software, something like that, paraphrased, right? So that one has to come off because that one says above all else. So you put that one aside, but you take the other 11 and you say, you basically do a relative prioritization. Put one on the wall and say, whichever one it is, the art of not doing things, you know, I'm not good at citing these, but whichever one you put on the wall, you know, this is the first one. Then the next one you pull up, they're on a card and you say, is this more or less important to the group? And by the end of a 30 or 40 minute exercise, because you're having this conversation about all of the different principles, you have a prioritized list of principles. You put the first one back on top because that's what we value above all else. And you've aligned the room, first of all, to the principles of the Agile Manifesto, but you've also learned what's most important to your organization. And then you can start having discussions around, well, why is sustainability at the bottom? Or why is the business and IT partnership at the bottom? And that becomes a very powerful mechanism, I think, to see why things aren't moving up or why things couldn't move up or they shouldn't move up or what would be so destructive about moving this one up. And it just led to some really interesting questions that I think perhaps not every environment's right for this exercise, but I got a tremendous amount of value and it made me really think through what I value as an Agilist and what I really need to focus on and improve upon.
It's a very cool exercise that plays a lot off of what Woody even talked about creating the context to ask questions and ask meaningful questions, right?
About the things you have the most faith in or the most trust in, the things we most believe. So for me, I actually have a list. I don't have it in front of me right at this moment, of about 50 things that I've come to find are almost always useful for me. And so it's off of those that I'm most typically questioning myself. So I'll look at those, you know, like in any one particular week, I will have gone through all of them for a few minutes here or there. The idea that there are these things that I believe the most. What did I get wrong? Why is it that I believe this is the most important thing? And what's wrong with that? I want to ask myself that. It's kind of funny when I make mention of this, almost everybody wants to question me about the things I believe. And what I'm encouraging people to do is question themselves about the things they believe. Because really, we can't really change anybody else. It's kind of like you started with this earlier, Zach, the idea of, you know, what do you do when you come into this organization? And in reality, what I found, and I maybe I'll lay a little groundwork for this. I spent a number of years at a company where I found things were bad and they were never going to get any better. So I didn't know that for sure, but after observing it for a few years, I started getting that feeling. So I started working really hard to see if I could actually make a difference to make things better. And it resulted in me making friends with a handful of people that are some of my closest friends even to this day. It ended up with me understanding how to find people in an organization who are ready for exploring ways to make things better. Now, not everybody has the same idea as what better might be, And that's why I like the principles like the Agile Manifesto. Then we can talk about them just like I think this forced ranking concept that you had, stack ranking the principles. That's a real good questioning mechanism. Why don't we just take the things like that? And there's a lot of people have written about, you know, strengths-based leadership and principles-based leadership and so on. And they have various exercises for let's get down to what we really value as quick as we can and consider it good enough for now as we go forward at a little bit deeper level than we were before. So this one thing I would share is that at first I tried things like, this TDD stuff looks really great to me. It's been working good for me. Anybody else want to learn it? And I could find a few people who wanted to do that. Or I would try this idea that's worked for me many times. I would read an article. I'd always look for the next thing to read that's short and makes some good inroads into something I'm interested in. I'll print it out. And I'll have a couple copies, and anytime I'm in a conversation across a company, I'll say, hey, I got this article I just read. I'd like to know what you think. Now, whether they read it or not tells you a lot. Whether they get back to you to talk about it tells you a lot. And whether they agree with you or not tells you a lot. And I don't necessarily have to share articles about stuff I agree with. It can be any topic that's related to the things that are interesting to me on making this a better place to work. That's a nice little thing. You just open up the door, and if people are willing to join you with that, great. And if not, no big deal. So these are gentle ways to say, hey, I'm interested in something here. And then at this particular location I was talking about, I found a handful of people, six or seven, who across the company who were interested in a lot of these things. And as I worked with them over the years, we got a lot of stuff done, which you might think under the radar. And then when an opportunity came for us to take on a project that was really, in a lot of ways, a very troubling thing, those were the people who naturally gathered to it. And we sort of, I was asked in a way to kind of join the team, and nobody wanted to be on this team because it was a miserable mess. And I said, you know, I would love to join this team. And then they said, oh, good, then Woody, you're there, as long as we get to do it in my own way. And by that time, they just wanted somebody to blame when everything went wrong. So they gave it to me. And then the first thing we did was we opened up the Lean Software Development book from Mary Popendix and Tom. And that's what we did. We went through the book. We learned to do value stream maps and all the things that are in there. And we had a resounding success with this project. So, you just got to keep offering to others that we can explore, we can question, we can learn. Let's step forward.
So, Woody, I hate to put you on the spot, but I'm wondering, what is the next big idea? So you've got No Estimates out there that's been resonating with people for a while now. mob programming, which I just saw a picture on Twitter of a really sweet setup. 2 or 3 50-inch televisions, really nice conference table. It seems like people are like pimping my mob programming efforts here. I think it's going to be a show soon. It looked like an arcade, but it looked amazing. So, but what's the next, and I not necessarily hashtag, but what's the next idea that's brewing in that brain of yours, and what's going to be the new thing we're talking about in the next 12 months?
Yeah, well, if I knew that, would I be bothering? I have no idea. We're going to discover that. This the whole thing about this is about serendipity. I read a book recently, really speaks to a lot of the things that we're talking about here, called Wiki Management. I'll get you the author's name here. I should have it memorized. I believe it's a guy. The guy's name is Rod Collins. And he's actually talking about a lot about this, the idea of all these disruptive things that have come along and completely changed industries. But I'm going to share, if you don't mind, I'll share a little bit that is in that book. It's kind of fundamental part of that book. So I will share something with you before we go on. You've probably noticed in Twitter that every now and then, sometimes weekly, I post out saying, hey, I've got a half hour or an hour to talk about No Estimates or mob programming or anything agile. And almost invariably, I'll get 2 or 3 takers, but I only have a small amount of time, so I'll try and arrange with others to speak later on. But it's pretty much like what we're doing here right now. We just ramble on. Sometimes it's more about a specific problem or a specific situation. Sometimes it's about much more general things than this. But this is a, if people are wondering, what's that like? It's kind of like this. So anyways, let me share this one little bit. Okay. He's got this concept here. It's sort of like the Agile manifesto, but I'm just going to read it off. There's five items. Serendipity versus planning. Self-organized versus centrally organized. Emergent versus directed. Simple rules versus detailed coordination. Transparency versus control. I liked all of that. I think that's the future is this connected world. But I'm not leading that conversation. That's coming from many, many other people. You know, you got the Kinefin and ideas, and you've got the beyond budgeting things. You've got all kinds of new management ideas. And I think that that's what these are the things we need to be following. But I, from my own personal cache of things, mob programming and no estimates are little tiny little things compared to the things we need to be dealing with. They're just things that happen to pique people's interest at this particular moment. The things that I'm thinking about related to these include the idea not just of mob programming as an idea where we get everybody together to work together, but also how do we get people to work together when we can't be together? How can we solve our communication problems when we're divided by time zones and by languages, and so on and so on? I can envision a world easily where we can become much more excited about our daily work, that we can excel in what we do moment by moment, that the environment is in place where great things just happen. And you know, that quote that I use from Robert Henri all the time is that the object isn't to make art, it's to be in that wonderful state where art is inevitable. And if I use it from my own point of view, it's if we allow people, that's probably the wrong term, but if things are in place where people are can do awesome things, they will do awesome things. If things are in place where people can do awesome things, they will do awesome things. It's just, those are the things we need to be paying attention to. When we pay attention to the wrong things, those things drop by the wayside. And if we focused on making it easy for people to be excellent or find their own excellence, then we're going to get real good results. And if we're looking for ways to control our processes, then we've abandoned the chance to get the real good results.
Yeah, it's an exciting time. If you think about the technology we have, what we've learned and what we know, I mean, in the last couple of years, I've seen a movement, at least in the companies that I've talked with, that I didn't see, you know, a few years back, really starting to look and question the evolution of organizations, like the promotion model, the management paradigm in companies, and looking at how different systems of work could make people happier, which could result in better products and more innovation. And it's an exciting time because we've never been this capable, you know? And if we can free ourselves up to that infinite potential of people to solve really complex problems, I think some amazing things could happen in some of these next generation organizations. And that to me is just like you said. I mean, for me personally, that's the thing that's most on my mind. Not necessarily some of the little things about how we're building software. It's kind of the idea of what an agile organization looks like and how business 50 years from now will hopefully people will think of work entirely different than they do today. And that's what excites me. So,
you know, I love the comments you guys are making about the nature of work. I actually think we're up for a renaissance. We used to have craftsmen. You'd work with your hands, you'd make amazing, beautiful things. It would take time. It'd be well crafted. It would be almost built to last and built in this spectacular way. It was just a true piece of art, regardless of you're a blacksmith, a woodworker. In more modern times, you're a carpenter. You're whatever work you're doing, it was a skilled trade. And now, with the technology era and the technology age, that thinking kind of went to the wayside for a bit. But what I've been seeing is that people want to get back to XP, and they want to get back to the idea that we're craftsmen and craftswomen in this space. And I love it. I love seeing us go back to a set of values and principles and practices such as XP that force us to do the right things in a gentle, loving way, and that also allows us and empowers us to create quality stuff. And I love seeing that is emphasized now, the quality that teams are demanding to be allowed to deliver quality. And I hope that continues, because that will drive, I think, a lot of things as well.
So this is an important thing, and this is a very difficult thing. The practices that we are finding are really excellent for us. In the future, we will look back on and say, yeah, look at how we used to do things. So a real good example for us right now is this frequency of deployment that people can have. So when the Agile Manifesto was written, you know, that first principle that you were mentioning is actually addresses the idea of continuously delivering valuable software. So that concept of continuous delivery was there way back when. You know, our highest priority is to satisfy the customer through early and continuous delivery of valuable software. Now, there's a step beyond continuous delivery, but in those days, continuous kind of meant every week or every 2 weeks. There were some people delivering stuff much more frequently, but now it's very, very much more possible to deliver, and there's models to do that with continuous deployment ideas and so on. And you see some companies, you know, won't quote specific companies that are deploying literally every change that gets made to their code base is automatically deployed or put into a deployed, I don't know, pipeline's not the right word, but it's going to be in front of users shortly if it passes all tests and so on. So these things are big. These are big differences and big changes that are happening. Craftsmanship in software development, I think it's a critical concept that we have to pay attention to these things. The cost to us of not paying attention to them is very, very high. Now, it's always going to depend on the purpose of the software, but it's rare that paying attention to the craft of it is not a good thing to do. Even with stuff that you think you're going to throw away, what I've often seen is, let's say over a two-week period where we're experimenting with something, by the end of that two-week period, things can become very difficult to work with if we didn't do a good job of keeping them easy to work with. So do we want to be effective every day or just for the first few days? No, I think we want to be effective every day. I work with some amazing people. Is it okay to make an advertisement?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I work with some amazing people in industrial logic. I would say some of the most brilliant people in this space today. They've dedicated their lives to helping people learn to be excellent at delivering software, at writing software, at having a livable work environment, at having practices that give us confidence in the work we do. Some of my earliest readings that I've done on these subjects came from people in this company. I really think the whole industry is, like you were saying, it's in a renaissance. We really do realize that we need this. And I'm really glad for myself to be part of a group that's trying to do this. So that's my advertisement. I would say for myself, it's an honor to work for these folks at Industrial Logic and work side by side as a team member with these brilliant people. I would like to invite anybody to get in touch with me through Twitter. If you ever do want to talk about Skype about any of these topics, and no charge, of course. It just has to fit into my time. If you run into me at a conference and you have nice things to say, then please come right up and talk with me. And if you have nasty things to say, I'm sure someone wants to hear about it, so you can go talk to them. Because that's the way these things are, right? I want to know how you're doing, what you're doing, how we can work better to make this a better world of work for us. I really, truly feel that if we grasp how to do that, then we get better lives as well. And I invite everybody to join us in doing that.
Well, Woody, Zach and I surely are honored that you took time out of your evening to join us. Really appreciate all the time that you've donated to me to help me learn more about Agile. I know, Zach, I'm sure you feel the same way about just the generosity of time that Woody's shown. And there's any closing remarks you'd like to make tonight, Woody? I want to be respectful of your time. I think we've hit our time box, but any other plugs or any other items you'd like to note before we wrap up tonight?
Well, first of all, thank you guys very much for inviting me to speak. There's a couple things I want to share. The first one is another Peter Block, and that's to me this is really important. The value of another's experience is to give us hope, not to tell us how or whether to proceed. I started off sharing things about mob programming because people started asking me about it at a particular conference. Somebody had seen what we did and was telling other people, you've got to see what these crazy guys are doing. And the no estimates was almost exactly the same thing. I had been in a conversation with Vasco Duarte and Neil Killick and Ron Jeffries, and I had been sharing a little bit of an idea of how I'd worked on a particular project where I didn't use estimates for trying to figure out the cost, really the time to get something done. And Ron kind of asked me, well, why don't you write a blog post about that? So I did, and I tagged it in with a hashtag in Twitter of no estimates. And so it was just the idea that I'm sharing some things that I've done, and maybe other people can get some hope that they can make their own things better. But I have another quote I want to share, if I could do that. This one's from Russell Eckhoff. I think I love this one. Managers who don't know how to measure what they want settle for wanting what they can measure. This is a quote that I learned a while back, but it just seems to be so pervasive that I want to spread that around quite a bit. I want people to think about, why are we measuring the things we're measuring? That may be a big theme that I'll pick up on, but for the time being, I'd like to make it clear we need to be thinking about that, in my opinion. I question that for myself. Am I trying to measure stuff that is just I've settled on because it's something I figured out how to measure instead of being something that's really meaningful to measure? Because I'll take it a big step further. I think it's rare that we can measure the things that are truly meaningful.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard because you have to ask the question. Sometimes you just take the metrics and what we're measuring today and ask the question, how would I measure this up? How would I take what we're measuring today and try to look at it at a higher level? What would that measurement look like? And usually that gets us towards a stronger outcome, you know, for us to focus on that's more collective rather than oftentimes very individual based, which is less useful. So how can we measure it up? How can we go up to figure it out?
Zach, how can people reach out and torment you?
Well, I'm on Twitter. You can, you know, follow me it's my full name, at Zach Boniker, Zach, B as in boy, Onaker. You can get me on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is kind of an evil application, but you can, you know, connect me there. Or, yeah, as I said, message me or follow me on Twitter. And if you want my personal email, then let's chat. Because just like Woody, I enjoy these type of conversations, and I'm happy to donate my time to really anything as long as it's valuable.
And I'm Ryan Ripley. Once again, you can reach me on Twitter at Ryan Ripley. I'm also on LinkedIn with Zach. It is an evil app, but you can reach out and connect to me there. AgileAnswerMan.com for previous episodes of Agile for Humans. We're also available on iTunes and Stitcher. Your feedback is what keeps us going. We love our listeners. We get a lot of great messages through Twitter, through email. The feedback is humbling. The number of downloads, the fact that you guys are sharing this show, I am truly humbled that you guys are just spreading the word and just incredibly appreciative. If you like what you're hearing, please send a message. Tell us if you don't and you got good suggestions, tell us how we can do better. We're here to do better for you. Please go out to iTunes, leave a nice review. 5 is our favorite number, and 5 stars gets the show spread and the message out even further. Thank you again for listening, and have a great evening.
Woody, thank you for being there.
Thank you much, guys. I really had a great time. How long are we going to talk?
4 days. We're going to do a straight 4 days starting now and just...
Well, that's not enough time to cover no estimates. So,
yeah, did you just estimate right there, Woody?
Like I often say, estimates are good for many things. That's one of my earliest arguments.